Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hi, this is Josh Marshall, and this is the Josh Marshall Podcast. We got a lot of things to talk about. You know, vaccine is in some ways the story of all stories, and not just because I guess we're still, I'm losing track now. I guess it was last week that we saw the British woman, elderly British woman, get injected with the vaccine. And now we're a couple days out from seeing people in the United States. It's been a really long time in this country since we have seen events where people are giddy. You know, the people who won the election, Biden people, very excited. You know, there's a lot of people who are very excited that Trump lost. That's, you know, it's sort of the other side of the same coin. There have been various things that have, you know, there were elements of excitement and happiness in the protests this summer. Obviously, it was about a very tragic, bad, awful thing, but there were triumphs in the process of the protesting. But it's been a really long time since you see people like getting excited about something that is unambiguously good. Even something with like Biden winning. And let's broaden it out, because Biden wasn't every Democrat's first choice, obviously. But the Democrats winning, ending Trump's presidency. A lot of people are excited about that. But again, it's part of it's an excitement that is subsidiary to the disaster that we have seen over the last 4 years. And yet, the vaccine, even though I guess you could say something similar, but something just a little different. This is science, you know, kind of blowing through the door and coming to the rescue. And it really is, I mean, this, I think that the forensic epidemiologists would say that this disease is about 13 months old. The sort of the earliest signs of it seem to go back to mid-November in China. And in the U.S., what, first cases in January? Basically, less than a year. There's actually a vaccine. That is remarkable, absolutely remarkable. And I'm sure you've seen, like I saw, I can't remember the guy's, wait, is Jared Polis? Is Jared Polis the governor of Colorado, who I'm losing track of who's who. Anyway, governor of Colorado, I'm spacing on whether I have the right name. You know, like a lot of states, they did like a kind of like a little ceremony, you know, waiting at the door for the FedEx guy to knock and bring in the vaccines. And again, there's just something, you know, you can look at that and you're like, wow, it's a vaccine. This is going to end. This is going to end. You know, we're not talking about a wave ending. We're not talking about someone getting out of the hospital. We're not talking about, you know, a kind of a treatment that's promising. This vaccine, you know, we still don't know exactly how long the immunity lasts. But even if it turns out that it's, you know, short term, you get a booster every year. I mean, that would be a continuing major public health thing to do, but that's doable, right? That's not impossible. And the efficacy is amazing. It's like well over 90% for most of these vaccines. And, you know, flu vaccine, I think, is like 70%. You have to get into stuff like the measles vaccine to have something that effective. So it has been a while since we have had a story that is just 100% good. And not only good, but wow, it's good to have a society when you invest a lot of money in the sciences. And this isn't just about, you know, kind of the immediate thing today in our era where Democrats are more, you know, kind of more funding science, or Republicans are skeptical about science. We've been at science for hundreds, arguably for thousands of years. This is just a very exciting thing. And there are obviously challenges with getting people actually vaccinated. But this is not just something that will save a lot of lives. It will allow those of us who have remained healthy to go back to living our lives, to see our friends, that those of us who have children can see their friends again. It will allow businesses to start functioning again. It's just a good thing. And so that is going to be, you know, one of the big, big stories for months. And good because it's a good story. You know, there are challenges along the way. I did a post a couple days ago that was based entirely on the reporting of Josh Kovensky and our co-host Kate about, you know, the small issue that there's no plan to vaccinate everybody, right? And there's no, and they haven't put up a budget for it. Basically, the Trump administration has a plan for the absolutely critical but relatively small part of the population that is people in assisted care facilities and healthcare workers. They are both the groups that absolutely need to go first, but that's still a relatively small slice of the population. The plan is that you can get those people vaccinated in December and January, and then kind of you go on to, you know, mass inoculation for the rest of the society. Only that is just being kind of left to the states, and there's no budget for it. And this is a massive undertaking. It would be hard for states to do it in any case, but states are already slashing every budget right and left because of the reasons we know about. So that is a problem. I'm sure we're going to get through that problem, but it is a big problem, and it is not insignificant that it is also a potential political time bomb. Probably designed intentionally to blow up on Joe Biden. That, you know, he got everybody totally excited about the vaccine now. And if people in the first days of February are going like, hey, where the fuck is my vaccine? Trump was killing it. I mean, you know, words have many meanings. Trump was killing it. And then Biden came in. What's the deal? Why isn't Biden getting the vaccines out? So, Those are topics we are going to talk about. Before we do, let me give you a quick word from our sponsor. Breaking weather report. We're looking at another dark, frigid winter with a 99% chance of crushing depression and Zoom fatigue. Wow, this copy is kind of a downer. Sure. Warm up the winter blues with Grady's reusable all-in-one cold brew kit. With 36 servings per bag, our velvety smooth coffee concentrate is brewed strong for a caffeine kick you can enjoy hot or iced. Just add water. Ready to give it a swirl? Get 25% off your first order at gradyscoldbrew.com with promo code TPM. That's gradyscoldbrew.com with promo code TPM. And I have my Grady's right here if you're watching on the video.
You know, Josh, the impending snowstorm here kind of reminds me of that famous customer service experience where you got some Grady's just under the wire of a blizzard in your Manhattan apartment.
Yeah,
right?
I think there's a photo of it in our the 20th anniversary package that is going live today. Yeah, this was like in I don't think it was Sandy. Maybe it was Sandy. There was some big, you know, nor'eastern hurricane, probably nor'easter, bearing down on us, and we didn't have any Grady's, and I probably tweeted, like, I need some Grady's. This is like a serious public health emergency. And Grady's sent out one of their employees, hand delivered a shipment of Grady's to our apartment. And, I mean, you know, we bought it, right? It wasn't like they didn't give it to us, but they hand delivered it. And so this was, you know, long before I knew Grady or Grady was sponsored or anything like that. That's real Grady service.
Yeah, that's the rest is history, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. I think that must be how I got to know them.
Yeah, for anyone listening who's a fan of TPM, you should definitely check out our anniversary package. Lots of cool features, including a glossary of Josh Marshallisms, such as underbussing, which was one that I had kind of forgotten about, but a highlight there, and some other great stories too. So anyways, Kate, like Josh was alluding to, can you tell us more about your reporting with Josh Kavinsky and the kind of trouble with the vaccine? Because I think, like Josh mentioned, you know, it's very heartening to see, you know, the first vaccinations in the U.S. I thought it was kind of surprisingly moving to watch on Monday as, I guess it was an ICU nurse in Queens or on Long Island, somewhere kind of over there, received, I think, the first dose of the vaccine in the U.S. And
was she the first in the U.S. or first in New York?
I think she was the first in the U.S. Yeah.
Kind of makes sense. New York goes first, given... Yeah, I mean, seriously, given everything that happened. Yeah, I mean, given Trump's nonsense. But I'm in more just... how it began, you know, the sort of the trajectory of the epidemic in the United States.
Totally. So yeah, so pour some cold water on all of our happiness and good cheer. Okay. Tell us kind of what you found as you've been reporting.
I did want to join in the cheer for a quick second. Just say kind of two things that two stats, I guess, that made the vaccine's development, I don't know, just putting into more context for me, someone who doesn't, you know, specialize in vaccine development, is that before this, the fastest vaccine that they developed was for the mumps, I think, and it took 4 years. I mean, that just like throws it into such stark relief. And the other thing is that the FDA was prepared to approve a vaccine that had over 50% efficacy, which is just like, you know, that's crazy that's kind of the threshold that we were like expecting. And then we have these like 94, 95% effective vaccine. So, you know. That is my moment of celebration.
I remember early in the vaccine when Fauci was talking about this in one of these White House press conferences, he talked about that, you know, you have the normal trial period, mm-hmm. right, when you're testing it. But he said sometimes you see what was the phrase he used? I think he said an efficacy signal showing up. And if it's strong enough, you call the trial off and you move ahead. I mean, not, you know, you probably continue, but mm-hmm. basically if you get an early sign, you may move to production just because it's not, you know, this isn't some random thing that we just thought it might be a good idea to have a vaccine for. It's a public health emergency. So yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. So now, like you say, DT to pour cold water on all that, Josh described it well, you know, the crux of the issue is that the Trump administration has been pretty much abdicating all responsibility for the COVID pandemic from the beginning, pretty much just leaving it to fall onto the states and local governments. But now we're at a place where this many months into the pandemic, already chronically underfunded public health departments just are tapped. They are out of money. Their resources are being strained. You know, those poor employees who have just been through absolute hell, you know, at this point are now going to be asked to like keep working enormous hours and try to help to do the vaccination campaign. And then you have this kind of incoming freight train that all the money that Congress was able to pass for state and local aid was kind of in this coronavirus, you know, slush fund without the negative connotations. So like $150 billion pot that they would dole out to different states and local governments that needed them. All of that money, that aid, expires on December 31st. So whatever help the states had, and most of them have like run through their CARES money by this point, but that is running out anyway, which means that now, as states are kind of turning to setting up this enormous effort, a mass vaccination campaign with a vaccine that requires two doses, different amount of time between the two doses for the Moderna and Pfizer vaccine. The Pfizer one has to be stored at super cold temperatures. You need a way to track how people are getting the vaccine. You know, all of this huge effort they're doing basically with no money. And even this week, we've seen some movement on Capitol Hill about getting some COVID relief passed. But even now, it looks very unlikely that the $160 billion that was initially allotted for state and local funding was basically siloed into a package that's not going to pass to ease the passage of the other part of the proposal, because it was such a poison pill to Republicans.
Put in that bill that where the legal immunity stuff goes.
The liability shield, right, and state and local aid, that is what was siphoned out as the deal breaker to each party. And just in case our listeners haven't been following, the liability shield deals with giving corporations and companies protection from employees suing them for making them work in dangerous working conditions during COVID, which that just puts it in pretty stark relief. That's Republicans' poison pill, or that's Democrats' poison pill. State and local aid is Republicans' poison pill. Now, the good news is that the package that seems likely to pass, and the way they're doing this is basically just stapling it onto the funding bill to keep the government from shutting down, that has to pass this Friday. That it looks like it's going to include $6 billion directly for vaccine distribution and infrastructure. So that will go to states to help them roll out the vaccine. Now, it's well under what a couple of the big groups of immunizers said that they need. They said it'll minimum $8.4 billion to roll out the vaccine smoothly. But that'll be something. And then you also have the CDC already gave out some money kind of through a grant type process to help states. They're doing another kind of unloading of, I think it's $150 million. So states can also apply to get a piece of that pie to help them. But the problem is, with this funding just coming in now, while the vaccine is already being deployed, that's a wave effect. That's going to slow down the whole process, because now they're just kind of standing up these processes to try to get things figured out. And kind of the political sabotage aspect of this is that whatever plan the Trump administration does have to deploy this initial wave, that's kind of the end of the road. You know, you run out of plank after that. There is no real plan for the next wave of vaccinations, which will be, you know, when everyone is getting vaccinated. There's not really much infrastructure there at all. It's much more of a, you know, we'll support the states however we can, which, as I say, are cash strapped and struggling from a lack of resources. So that's kind of where we're heading in now. And something Josh and I have been focusing on for a piece that we're kind of in the works of writing is, okay, this is, you know, a volatile situation. Whether or not it's kind of being done this way out of maliciousness to the Biden administration or because the Trump administration doesn't care or is abdicating responsibility, either way, you know, what can the Biden administration actually do, especially if Congress doesn't get its act together and get more money right to the states? So that's kind of what we're looking at now. And a big piece of that is public messaging, because, you know, Trump has kind of led a good portion of the country to believe that COVID is overblown, not real, nothing worse than the flu. So that's a huge effort to overturn that. And then you also have kind of a big public messaging effort that needs to be undertaken, especially for communities in America that have high levels of, you know, they call it quote unquote physician distrust, you know, a lot of which, especially for the Black community, stems from decades of medical mistreatment. So that's also something you have to overcome. And that bit of it is really important because especially Black Americans, especially Hispanic Americans, have been disproportionately ravaged by the pandemic. So you also need to find a way to make sure the vaccine is getting allocated fairly, and especially with a focus on those communities, and that they don't get missed in this wave of relief as well, just kind of continuing the cycle of damage. So those are ways that the Biden administration can kind of control, you know, a messaging aspect, a bird's eye view to make sure the vaccine is getting allocated fairly across states and within states to these communities. But we are at a point where, you know, I spoke to someone at Kaiser yesterday who just told me we're kind of past the point where the federal government is going to be able to help in a real boots on the ground kind of way, because it takes a lot of time to set up those kind of, you know, that those logistics. And by the time the Biden administration gets in, after we're in this like kind of dead zone right now, states are already going to have to be kind of jerry-rigging their own system to get vaccines to people.
Okay, do you think, I mean, have you come across what some of the solutions might be? You know, I guess it just brings to mind some of the pop-up COVID testing sites, mm-hmm. for instance. Could those just be kind of, you know, turned into vaccination sites, you know, or pulling in more pharmacies or, you know, minute clinics or kind of urgent care facilities that are already doing the testing and such like that? Or is it too soon to tell exactly how they solved that problem?
Well, I mean, all of those are good ideas, but it also, that kind of goes to the real lack of plan right now, that those are good ideas, not necessarily anything that's more solid than that. But you do have pharmacies at this point kind of being pulled in, particularly to serve long-term care facilities like nursing homes. And that's going to be a federal-private partnership where the vaccine gets sent directly to, you know, CVS, Rite Aid, and then they send vaccinators right to the facilities, do the vaccinations there. They're in charge of, you know, reporting back the data and everything like that. And the vaccine is given at no cost to the pharmacies. So that's something that is being used in this kind of first wave of most urgent deployments that I think they'll probably, you know, try to continue that partnership with the broader vaccination attempts, especially because, as you say, you know, some of the ways that people do the flu vaccine, for example, that might have been helpful if not for the season is, you know, big vaccination fairs where there it's outside, you know, you're in and out. That kind of stuff is harder, you know, now that it's winter. And then you also have those stumbling blocks we've had all along, which is COVID makes being inside less safe. And that is going to play a factor in these vaccinations as well, especially if people are primarily going to, you know, their doctor to get the vaccine.
I guess one thing that's worth mentioning here, and correct me if I'm wrong, Kate, that it takes a month or so to develop your immunity, whether you have one shot or two shots. So basically the point is, it's not, no one should think, well, hey, I'm going indoors to get the shot, but I'll have the shot. So even if there was some COVID there, I'll be good. So it does not work that way. You are still vulnerable to COVID for a few weeks. So on the CVS and I guess Walgreens kind of places, I guess the idea is that their personnel, the people they have who work for those companies, who are the people that if you go to get your flu shot down at the local CVS, they've got people who know how to give an injection. I guess it's, you know, pharmacists can do it. And, you know, it's not, it's a relatively straightforward thing. But I guess that it's great that they have a plan to get those people. I mean, I think two friends or acquaintances of mine, who I've seen, and it's heartbreaking, people who, parents in long-term facilities, who both got COVID in the last few weeks. I think one of them already died. Weeks. And I remember one of these people, again, just an acquaintance, I saw them discussing it on social media. And this woman was, you know, had a sort of an incandescent rage in her words that, you know, the assisted living facility that her mother was in, by definition, had kept the people in that facility COVID-free for what, 9 months, 8 months, all this time, you know, totally locked down, all the extreme measures you can imagine until, you know, 3 weeks ago. A couple people got it, then more, and swept through the whole place. And I think her mother's already died. And, you know, obviously, elderly people in assisted living facilities have been dying in great numbers all year. There's just something particularly heartbreaking to think just a couple weeks, right? Just if it had just been a few weeks. So there's a lot of surplus of heartache and loss and anger that will take a long time to subside.
I think that's true, especially just for older Americans, you know, across the board, who have had to be so careful and, you know, like, haven't even been able to kind of do the small things that people who are less at risk have done, you know, just grocery shopping or going to the pharmacy to get a new toothbrush. You know, it's just so grueling for them. So I don't know. I'm very glad that at least they're being prioritized in this first wave, you know, the people who have sacrificed the most, the healthcare workers, and then older Americans.
Yeah. Kate, can you talk a little bit about the public messaging you mentioned kind of a little bit earlier? I'm curious, you know, have polls shown recently that maybe half of Americans are willing to get vaccinated kind of right away, or maybe somewhere around there? Which, you know, I guess, what is our flu vaccination rate? Something like that?
Yeah.
I think it's less? I thought it was like, isn't it like 30%? I'm always surprised how low it is. But Kate, you would know. You've been reporting on this.
I want to say in the mid-40s, but I haven't specifically reported on the flu since the summer. So that might be a little shaky in my head. But
But the public messaging is sort of to obviously convince people it's safe, convince people they should get the vaccine. I mean, you know, you talked about obviously medical malpractice and distrust among certain, you know, minority communities and things like that. But just talk to us a little bit more about that, how to overcome some of those, I don't know, messaging challenges or to spread the word, basically.
Yeah, well, it's even in a normal, you know, like getting the people to get the flu vaccine, which has been around for a while and doesn't really have the same kind of nerves maybe about how quickly it was developed or how new it is. It's really hard to get people to do that, partially because we have a very flourishing anti-vax movement in this country. And then also kind of how I mentioned, certain communities have more of a distrust of, you know, institutional medicine for good reason. But now there's the added layer of COVID and the fact that Trump has kind of stoked COVID conspiracy theories, and there's been a complete vacuum of any federal messaging about it. And actually, Kaiser, to go back to the conversation I had the other day, is starting to do once monthly polls to try to gauge vaccine confidence. And when I was talking about the one they just put out, you know, Republicans were one of the highest groups of people who distrust the vaccine and who wouldn't get it and have concerns about it.
But Trump developed it himself, basically, and like Josh, you wrote in the study in the White House, right? So how could they not be on board with the awesome, all-powerful Trump vaccine?
Yeah, that idea I feel like has birthed a million thought pieces about how you just need to give Trump credit for the vaccine, so he'll tell people to get it, you know, and kind of fight back against that. And,
in any normal presidency, the way this would shake out would be that, you know, Biden's president, he's doing his thing, but Trump would be maybe informally deputized as, like, you know, the apostle to Trumpers, right? Of the person who's going to go out and convince them it's all going to be good. You know, the one thing that occurs to me, and I'm sure this is going to be a basic thing that is going to be such a challenge for the public health community, is that on the one hand, you're going to have a big problem with people who are skeptics about vaccine, people who don't have, you know, who don't have a doctor, who don't have health insurance, and maybe, sure, they can maybe, you know, maybe you're going to be able to go into the CVS and get it for free, but you're not kind of familiar with the medical system, blah, 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 blah. At the same time, you're going to have tens of millions of people who are going to be speed dialing their doctors and saying, give me the vaccine. I need it today. I need it today because I haven't been able to do this thing and that thing and the other. You know, very understandable. We all want this to be over. But you're going to have both of those things happening at the same time, right? And you know, one thing that struck me is you've mentioned a few times, Kate, rightly, that you have many historically marginalized communities in this country have a high rate of distrust of the medical profession. And some of that is just part of, you know, is inherent in what we call marginalization. You know, you're pushed back from the centers of expertise and power and stuff like that, particularly the case for African Americans, because there's this whole history of literally using African American populations as like guinea pigs in healthcare studies. You know, we have Tuskegee experiment, you know, we know all that history. And one of the interesting things, and from one perspective, you might say, and I would agree with this to a significant extent, because it's communities that have very little experience of this, but you have high, one of the things that defines core Trumpism is people who have very low social trust. Now, the archetypal Trumper, you know, kind of guy with a, I don't know, guy who's a general contractor living in a, you know, kind of semi-rural area of a state, not doing too bad financially, high school degree, blah, 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 white man, right? This is not a historically marginalized community, yet you do have some of, you know, similar attitudes about public trust and authority. You know, it's funny, there's, I don't know if any who will remember this, but there was this SNL sketch a few years ago. It had Tom Hanks, and it's one of these sketches they've done a number of times called Black Jeopardy. Okay. And so what it is, and Tom Hanks is a Trumper, a white Trumper. Right. So they start the thing and everybody's like, who, you know, kind of who's this guy, right, on Black Jeopardy. And the joke is, and you gotta have to see it, I'm smart enough that I'm not gonna try to get into the nuances of it, but that the black contestants, you know, basically their questions all have to do with, you know, not trusting authority, not trusting the man, ways to kind of ways that people in African American communities have different way of doing things that are different from the dominant culture. And the joke is that and I think it's two black women are the other contestants. They end up agreeing a lot with the Trump guy because they both have the same distrust, right? You have to see it, but it is it does you know, this is not the thing about low vaccine trust in the Trump world is obviously hugely driven by Trump and him being a gigantic dick and having screwed this up so badly, but it is a sort of a taproot of Trumpism in the first place. Low social trust. You know, Hillary seems good. She's the worst. She's, you know, she's just doing it for the money, and she's in, you know, she's in bed with the people exporting the job, you know, all that kind of stuff. So there's a lot of challenge with this vaccine. And the things that will make it hard to get people to buy into the vaccine are the same things that really bedevil our society and our political process.
Yeah. Well, maybe we can shift gears a little bit, spend the last part of the show talking about the incoming Biden administration. Obviously, on Monday, we had the official Electoral College vote certifying his win once again. So much winning over the last month and a half for Joe Biden. Georgia three times or so, Wisconsin a couple times, right? And now it's official. And Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell finally came out and said, congratulations to the president-elect, only like, you know, a month and a half late. But Biden has been building out his administration. I think maybe just in the last 24 hours, we've had a couple key nominees named, including Mayor Pete Buttigieg for Transportation Secretary and former Michigan Governor Jennifer Granholm as Energy Secretary, I believe, right? Kate, you had mentioned you had some thoughts kind of about how it's shaping up. Let's hear it, some of those.
Well, yeah, my thoughts are mostly on Buttigieg, I'll say. But I don't know. I'm interested to hear what your guys' reaction was. But when I saw yesterday that he was being named Transportation Secretary, it's just like, what? Why? What possible experience does he have in transportation? And to some degree, I kind of think he was chosen the same way that Biden has chosen his whole cabinet, which is, here are the people that I want to choose. Now let's try to match them as best we can with a cabinet position.
It kind of felt like a consolation prize a little bit for Buttigieg. You know, obviously he's like a young guy and a sort of a rising star in the party. I think he's gotten like some praise, so to speak, for like his Fox News hits and stuff like that, kind of like going against the grain a little bit. I loved Amy Klobuchar's Midwestern shade that she threw at, at Buttigieg, saying like, oh, your local government experience will be such a great asset to the Biden administration.
Government experience.
Exactly. Which is kind of a classic Midwestern nice thing, not being so nice. And, you know, Granholm, I don't know much about her experience with the energy sector at all, other than, I guess, you know, she's a former state executive and, you know, she's someone who's been in the party for... Yeah, exactly.
Michigan cars. Yeah. I was
that almost makes more sense for transportation in a way, right? When you think about it.
It's funny because I know who Granholm is. You know, she's been out of office for a while. I was a little surprised to see that she's actually getting a pretty big thumbs up for people on the sort of the more left side of the green, you know, sort of climate movement, that they're pretty into her. I guess she's, you know, she's made, this is a big issue for her. So with the Buttigieg thing, one of the primary qualifications for being transportation secretary is not being qualified. I mean, it is just true. It's just true, right? I mean, it's actually, I just glanced, and in the last 20 years or so, I think there's been at least two other mayors who've gotten the gig. You know, transportation is a very core issue in local government always. Traffic, do you going to put in, you know, public transportation, roads? You know, it is a kind of a core local government issue. It's also often, you know, it's kind of a consolation prize. You know, it's a cabinet set, you know, cabinet, but like, come on, right? I mean, barely, right? I don't know. People have strong feelings about Pete. I mean, they really do. They just have strong feelings about him. I guess I'll put it that way.
My thing with it is just, I get it. Transportation is a more minor secretary position. And, you know, you get to make history by having the first, presumably Senate-confirmed, openly gay cabinet secretary. And, you know, Pete put in the steps for the Biden administration. So they're trying to kind of both foster his rising star and thank him for that. But I guess my initial reaction was... To me, the most important thing that the Biden administration has to do is curb climate change. It has to be the first administration we've had that, like, meaningfully makes it a constant priority. And it's just, we're at the point where if that doesn't happen, we don't have to bother talking about it anymore because we've fully written our fate. But while it's still maybe a little bit reversible, it is his place in history has to be to keep the climate disaster from escalating. And I just think if the Democrats lose the Georgia...
Biden or Buttigieg?
Well, I'm talking about Biden in general.
Okay, right.
But I was about to go
absolutely,
into...
Absolutely,
If the Democrats lose the runoffs in Georgia, the only way that he is going to be able to do that is through, you know, the regulatory powers, through the cabinet, through the agencies. And transportation seems to me to be an area where you can affect really meaningful climate-related change, you know, whether that be through making public transit work better and be more robust, or, you know, electric vehicles or, you know, whatever, all that stuff. It just seems to me a prime area that change can be made. And I think Buttigieg is a smart person. And so my hope is that he kind of gets these, you know, gets undersecretaries or top deputies who actually know something about the transportation sector or who have worked extensively with public transit or something, and kind of dedicates himself to learning some stuff and just spending his whole time there trying to make, you know, to make green transportation a thing, you know, right, more of a thing than it is now.
And I guess one of the challenges for Biden, too, is that because the Senate majority is literally in the balance, and if both runoffs go Democrats' way, it's literally a 50-50 split plus Kamala Harris being the tiebreaker, that you can't name any sitting senators to your cabinet, right? So the fact that Mayor Pete is available, I guess, is a plus for him, right? You can't have Klobuchar, like I mentioned, or Elizabeth Warren, for that matter, or, you know, because they're kind of, they're needed in the Senate for kind of any hope of legislating during Biden's term.
I think there's definitely been a legitimate hit on Biden, that a big factor for him is trust. I don't think it's being friends or chummy. I think it's trust. He is really focused on, I know that person, trust that person, I can work with that person. You know, that's something like, I'm spacing on his name. I actually know the guy who got VA, Dennis McDonough. That is a case, that you know, that doesn't, not an obvious thing there to be VA. Dennis is a really good administrator, so I actually think he'll be really good at it. But that was a case where it's really clear he's worked very closely with Dennis. Dennis was like chief of staff for the National Security Council, and then eventually chief of staff. So kind of, I trust that guy. I want that guy in the mix high up. I think that's a legit critique. With Buttigieg, this is pretty standard. He was one of the strong presidential, you know, contenders, just by definition. I'm not saying he was great, but he was one of the relatively last people standing. You know, he got support, blah, 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 blah. People in those positions get cabinet positions. That's tradition. He's out of work, right? I mean, he needs a job, even aside from not looting the Senate and that kind of stuff. And Biden, I mean, again, that part of it, I think, is just, that is how our politics works, for better or worse. But there's also, I mean, I think the other thing that Biden is, you know, the word transactional has gotten a very bad reputation with Donald Trump. But Biden is a fairly transactional politician in a somewhat different sense of just like, you know, get all the key people together, make sure no one feels excluded, you know, different groups, different kind of ideology, you know, all that kind of stuff. I think he is, and I think he's done a relatively good job at this. He has been extremely focused on I'm not putting together an administration that is heavily identified with one viewpoint in the party, one clique in the party. I'm trying to make everybody feel included, right? And I think the Buttigieg thing is to a significant extent part of that. I mean, it's transportation department. Come on.
Right. And I think, is it true? I thought I saw a report today.
Not to
maybe
be hating
Biden
on the
was
transportation department.
Right. Biden was eyeing maybe a Republican or two for his cabinet.
Oh my
maybe
God.
As commerce.
Don't do it. So
as
stupid.
As commerce secretary or something.
Yeah. Obama already did it. We know what happens. You get a thumbs up for like 2 hours, and then you have to work with a Republican in your cabinet. My God, haven't we learned?
Although wasn't Ray LaHood Obama's transportation secretary also a Republican in
yes,
maybe the
was.
First term?
He was a Republican, moderate Republican. I mean, I think that I saw someone saying that, what is her name? Meg Whitman. Meg Whitman at this point, I mean, I think she supported Biden.
Right, like a more lot, of an anti-Trump conservative.
Yeah, I mean, you've got a lot of these people who are... You've got a lot of nominal Republicans who are kind of not really clear they're Republicans anymore. I mean, they
like
may
John
still
Kasich kind of. And
yeah, I mean, you know, well, Kasich's a little different. He was recently in office. Kasich's actually a pretty conservative guy, but you've got, you know, people like Meg Whitman, who I don't think was ever a particularly ideological. She's CEO. She's, you know, a Richie, and has very little truck with the Trumps, you know. So some of these people are kind of, you know, it's hard to say they're even like, you know, Republican. I mean, it would be sort of like if someone like, oh, I'm going to put Colin Powell in. He's a Republican. Well, no, he's not. He supported Obama twice. You know, I think he supported Clinton. But I certainly agree. You know, look, at a certain level, you're just trying to kind of check a box and not the end of the world. But I do, and maybe this is something we can talk about in the next episode. It is really, really important that Democrats take what I think is one of the critical lessons from the Obama years, is that you don't get into dances of engagement with Republicans, because good faith interacting with bad faith is an asymmetric losing proposition. So the whole idea of, oh, we're going to kind of, you know, there was this whole kind of blow up this morning with O'Malley saying, what is it, you know, Republicans are fuckers or something like that. And everybody, oh, you know.
So much for unity.
Yeah, so much for unity. And this is, you know, burning bridges with Trump. So, no. We need to move on the basis of you people are incredibly hostile to us. You're very destructive. We think what you have done is terrible. If you want to say that's calling you fuckers, we do think you're fuckers. And if there's some things we can work on together, let's do it for the country. But let's not get into this thing where we're kind of like, oh, let's... You know, Obama just spent months and years trying to kind of line things up and find common ground. And he was just being punked constantly. Constantly. Just like the Lucy and the football thing. You know, the reason we almost didn't get Obamacare is that he spent a year trying to find like half a dozen Republicans who he could bring them along and make it bipartisan, but they were just playing him. And we just can't do that anymore.
It rankles me so deeply, this idea of we are in a situation where the majority of Republicans in Congress were actively supporting an effort to undermine our democracy, and the Democratic response is, you know what, we're going to put one of you in the cabinet, even if it's a rhino or whatever. I just think the optics of that are insane. And it's just, it's to me, it's what you're saying. It's the Obama situation all over again. And you, not only is it stupid to try to meet good faith with bad faith, but you get nothing for trying. You get nothing. You barely get credit, much less any political heft. I mean, if there's anything we've seen from this election, it's that the core of the Republican Party is being anti the Democratic Party. And that's always true in politics to some degree, but it's just reached a level with the Republican Party that it's, you know, even if it means I'm going to go out there without my mask and go to a bar and die of COVID, I'm going to do it anyway because you don't like it, liberals. Like, that's insane. We've reached such a fever pitch that I just think, at all going back to this thing of acting like Republicans are a normal functioning party right now, is just so stupid on so many levels. And again, Biden will get no credit for trying. Republicans who are, you know, accepting the kinds who, you know, have kind of the Mitt Romneys, accepting those. But the Republicans in the base are not going to be like, you know what, he tried to unify with us, so let's give him credit. No, it's going to be taking his legs out from him on day one, no matter the cost to the American public. And acting like the party is anything other than that right now is just going to be shooting himself in the foot constantly. And he already has such a, you know, limited set of resources to work with that would just be so infuriating.
I completely agree with you. I would say this. I'm not going to lose a lot of sleep if he, nominates a Republican for something, whatever. I don't really care about that. But I care greatly about the basic posture that he approaches governing in the next 4 years. And one of the very basic things has to be, we will not engage with destructive, anti-democratic, small d democratic players with any kind of kabuki theater or nonsense about their feelings and about how, oh, you know, we were all going to get along, but then it turns out you said Lindsey Graham isn't nice and it's over. You really have to make almost like a pledge. We're not going to do that. You guys showed what you're about. We want to change that. We want to try to save the country. And we are going to use every legitimate power we have to do that. And if you want to, if you want to get involved, great. The door is open. But we're not going to wait for you to come through the door. We're not going to beg you to come through the door. We may send you, at the beginning, directions to get to the door, but that's it.
Yeah.
Because that is just, it. Not only is it not effective and time-wasting, but it is demoralizing to your supporters, and it signals weakness. Signals weakness. One of the things that, Donald Trump showed is in the process of breaking a lot of things, you know, you have to just produce things for your constituents, not just for your people, the way he did with farmers, but you have to show we can do things. We can make things happen for you that change the equation for you. There's a reason to vote for us. It's not all kind of rah-rah and your team. We can actually produce things. So, yeah, that's really key. And as I said, if he nominates one Republican, that's kind of just old-time tradition. He's an old guy. Whatever. I don't really care about that. But the posture he takes to governing is critical.
I also do think this might be kind of the way that Rahm Emanuel was to the transportation secretary job, in that by kind of like leaking that he was a shortlist contender, people got so pissed. And then when it was Buttigieg, they were like, okay, well, at least it's not Rahm Emanuel. You know, like, that was some ground softening. And this could be a case of it's going to be a Republican, and then it ends up being someone like, you know, far too moderate for people's taste or something like that. And then you're like, okay, well, not a Republican.
Right. It's like Jamie Dimon instead or something like that, like the CEO of JP Morgan. But maybe that's a good place to leave it today.
Yeah.
covered a lot of ground.
We did. Well, remember, Grady's Cold Brew Iced Coffee is a sponsor of the Josh Marshall Podcast. You can get 25% off your first order at gradyscoldbrew.com with promo code TPM.
All right. Christmas next week. We'll be back. Maybe we'll be back with an earlier in the week episode next week.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Accommodate the holiday or something. But talk to you guys then.
All right, later, folks.
Bye.
All right, bye.